Shalom, everyone. I'm Monty Judah with Lion and Lamb Ministries. Welcome to our program. We are in the midst of a study called False Gods and Idols, and we're really focusing in on the second and third commandment of when God gave the Ten Commandments through Moses to the children of Israel. Just by way of quick reminder of that those commandments come in Exodus chapter 20, beginning of verse 3, where he says, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, inflicting the punishment of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing favor to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments." Now, the sin of idolatry, going after believing in a false god as opposed to the creator God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the idea of creating something where you give it godlike qualities, meaning that it has a greater value to you than actual God, and you make it a god unto yourself by you valuing it, praising it, being thankful for it, and so forth. God says he doesn't want us to do that. But he goes another step further rather than just giving the commandment, don't do this. He says the reason why you don't want to do this is, he says, it has something to do with my character. This is God speaking. He says, I am a jealous God. And our program is really, the primary focus is on these commandments, and the characteristic that God describes himself as being a jealous God. If you stop and think about it for a moment, whenever you hear about someone else being jealous. Let's say that there's a man who's jealous about a particular thing or a woman who's jealous about, you know, a lot of us, when we hear that said about a person, we say, our first reaction is, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Or, yes, I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't really stir us up. And in fact, we actually will take someone who's exhibiting a lot of jealousy about it, and we'll say, hey, calm down, relax, you know, hey, move on to the next thing. Don't be preoccupied with this jealousy business that you've got going on. By the way, that argument is not going to work with God. You don't tell God, calm down on being jealous. The jealousy that God has is extremely severe. And let's take his point of view for a moment. He is the creator of the universe. He owns the entire universe. And you, who've been created by him, whether it be by yourself or whether you join in with others to do so, when you decide, well, I'm just going to ignore the real creator, the real God of heaven and earth, and I'm going to make this little goofy thing here that has popped up in my attention to be greater than him, apparently, God gets upset about that. And I think he kind of looks down and he says, you pipsqueak, what are you doing? And it's like we have no right to steal God's glory, misappropriate his glory. And the truth of the matter is, all forms of idolatry and following all false gods is a form of spiritual adultery. And it is despicable. Now, a lot of us don't really have that point of view from God's point of view, that is, on this subject. We tend to dismiss it. We tend to think of, well, idolatry is an ancient sin. And it is true. Amongst the ancients, they were very idolatrous. And in fact, in the last program they left you with, we talked about some of the false gods even the Bible talks about. I want to continue on in this episode. I want to just kind of review with you again some of this false god business and this idolatry business that has been in the ancient world And I'm going to lead you to understanding that just as Israel had to deal with this in their days, in the ancients, we have to deal with the same nonsense today. And the commandment that was given to Israel as they came out of Egypt is just as relevant for us today, for the world that we live in. But let's just quickly review for a moment. When the children of Israel first became formed as a nation, and if you'll recall, they were delivered out of Egypt, they went to Mount Sinai. This is when God gave those commandments and began to speak of those things. The nation they had come out of, Egypt at the time they came out had 40 different false gods. The children of Israel were living in the midst of that. They were having to contend with and deal with the Egyptians, not only oppressing them, but they had these false gods and they relied on them and they spoke of them in honor. And if you spoke against them or any dishonorable thing toward them, you know, you would incur the wrath of because of the Egyptian customs and traditions they had associated with it. The story of the 10 plagues coming out of Egypt, each one of those plagues, whether you realize it or not, was whacking with some of the major Egyptian gods. They had made a god out of bugs. They had made a god out of the River Nile. They'd made a god out of the storms and so forth. They had made a god out of the sun and so forth. And a lot of the different judgments trace to God is demonstrating to Pharaoh and to Egypt, that's not God, I'm God. And I'm an unseen God, but I'm powerful and I am in the midst of you. And in fact, if you go back and look at how Moses announced the judgments, that the ones that were announced to Egypt and so forth, you will hear Moses say, so that you will know that God is in the midst of Egypt. You know, the nation of Egypt was very large. Pharaoh, I want you to know that the God I represent is in the midst of all of Egypt. And then another judgment with him. I want you to know, Pharaoh, that God is in the midst of the whole world. He's not just in Egypt. He's in the whole world. I want you to know the Lord. And that is the key thing that was said in all of those judgments. It wasn't for the purpose. The judgments weren't for the purpose of the salvation of the children of Israel. The salvation of the children of Israel came forth by the Passover, by the blood of the Lamb. That was the story of redemption. So these judgments were to explain to the Egyptians and to the world and to Pharaoh, that's not God, I'm God. Now, with that said, you and I are living at the end of the ages, and we know there's a great tribulation going to come, and there's many judgments that are listed in the great tribulation. Do you think those judgments are for the salvation of God's people? No. Those judgments are to show the world that those things are not God, that I'm God, so that the world will know the Lord. Because I can assure you, on the day that Yeshua returns to the earth, nobody's going to be standing up and going, hey, I wonder what's going on today. We will know that there's a God of heaven who is returning and is full of wrath for against idolatry and the false gods that have been set up against him, not the least of which is HaSatan, Satan, who's decided to make himself greater than God. And he's going to destroy his enemies that try to do that and those that follow after him. Let's talk just for a moment about the famous golden calf, the idol that the children of Israel formed at the base of Mount Sinai after Moses had gone up to spend 40 days with the Lord. And this was after God had spoken the commandments, you know, have no other gods before me and do not make any idols. And yet there was a group, the children of Israel, that did this. Now, some have said, well, this is the trappings of the false gods they had in Egypt, and they were bringing some of those out. They never really quite left Egypt. And if you, on further examination, you'll discover, no, that's not true. That golden calf is not one of the gods that was back in Egypt. It's not one of the gods that was in other nations. That was a creation that was made by certain people in the children of Israel, and they were trying to depict the God that they had heard the voice from on Mount Sinai, had given the Ten Commandments. They were trying to create that God because they wanted to be able to see, touch, and they wanted him in their immediate presence where they could have him. Because, you know, Moses had gone and he was up there a long time. You know, what happened to him? You know, he's probably dead. He probably went away. You know, that God, you know. And they wanted it right here. And they wanted that, they wanted the control over God. So they said, make us a God. And you know what they said about that idol after? This is the God who brought us out of Egypt. And they had literally taken God who had brought them out of Egypt and falsified him. And it didn't take very long for them to do it. They immediately fell into the temptation to do it. Well, you know the story about how that God was destroyed. In fact, Moses, when he came back down, and those that did that, participated in that worship, they were killed and judged. And I should say judged and then killed. And they took that golden idol, you know, he pounded that down into a powder, pounded the gold down into literally gold flakes. He mixed in the water, he made the children of Israel drink it. And by the way, if you swallow a little bit of gold or silver into your system, it doesn't hurt you. It actually kind of cleans things up, kills bacteria and so forth. Yeah, how many of you know about colloidal silver? You know, it's something that a lot of people believe in that helps them. And gold has the same properties. A little more expensive to do that. In any case, it was a creation of the children of Israel in the midst of themselves. And it goes to show you the temptation of idolatry and how powerful and how strong it is. I shared with you last week, there's a very famous quote from a theologian by the name of Spurgeon, very godly man, church man, and so forth. He made a very interesting statement. He said, there's a God-shaped vacuum in every man. And if you look back at the creation and all of the men who've lived on the world, all the different nations and peoples and so forth, it seems to be the reason why all peoples have this spiritual need to fill that God-shaped vacuum that's inside them, the creator vacuum that's inside them, with something. So they create other gods, they create religions and try to fill that void that's inside of them. It can only be filled correctly by the one and true God. That's the only one that's going to satisfy you, is to know the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the creator God, and fill that vacuum with that. And men who do that, testify to contentment and wisdom and understanding of their life and fulfillment, whereas those who do not are always struggling because whatever they put in there doesn't quite fill the vacuum correctly, and they're struggling with trying to make it work, and it simply doesn't do it. Now, the children of Israel, when they came into the land after they dealt with the golden calf, they also had to deal with a couple of other gods that was in their surrounding neighbors. And we hear these stories in the Bible. For example, we hear about a god named Marduk. And Marduk is a Babylonian god. And again, one of these gods that's all about fertility and growing things. And he's kind of the leader of the Mesopotamian gods. And Mesopotamia is the land where Abraham came out of. And that land still exists when Israel came back into the promised land. And it was also worshipped, Marduk was also worshipped by the Persians and the Assyrians and these other powerful neighbors that Israel had in the area. Now, remember, you had the Egyptian gods that was down to the south of them, but we've got these other gods that comes from the others. The other one that they also hear about is from the Ammonites. Those are the ones that were immediately to the east of Israel, and that was Milcom. And Milcom has the names Molech, you know, different, and he's another false god. Now, we believe, and this is a kind of a consensus position that many of these false gods and these false things that were going around were probably controlled. They were probably the outworking of demons, that we think demons actually were spiritually interacting with those people in Babylonia and those people that were in the Ammonites, the Syrians, the Persians, and so forth, and that was part of what was involved there. In other words, if that vacuum is there and you don't know about the one true God, it's kind of like an open house, and demons love to go into an area where the Lord doesn't have power and control over, and they like to set up shop in people's lives. And so you have whole nations where there was demonic activity of that type, and it manifested itself in the form of a false god and a false religion. Now, we also move forward in history with Israel, and the Bible also speaks of another time in which they were going to be dealing with the Greco influence, the Greeks. If you look at world history of when the Babylonians were in charge and the Medes and the Persians came and overwhelmed them, and then you have the world overswept by them, and then you have the Greeks come along, and Alexander the Great came and he conquered the world, conquered the Persians and drove them back. Each one of these elements have different gods and different idols that they would use, and the Greeks had a bunch of them. Now, a lot of times when we talk about this culture, we'll refer to it as the Roman Greco culture, because the Romans effectively adapted the same gods as the Greeks. They just put a different name on them. Here's a table that shows you an illustration of the Greek name versus the Roman name of this. And I'm sure you're familiar with many of these names. Some might come as a surprise to you. But you've heard one of the names, either the Greek name or you've heard the Roman name, and maybe you didn't realize how closely in parallel they were. For example, in the Greek name, the big name god was Zeus. Well, the Romans referred to him as Jupiter. Then they had Hera, and whereas the Romans had June. And then you had Poseidon as the ruler of the raging main, the god of the ocean and the sea, and the Roman name, Neptune, is the counter name. When I was in the United States Navy, there are many naval traditions that have been with ancient sailors in their life. And there's different, depending on where you go in the sea, different things you may do when you were at sea, serving at sea in the Navy, you would win certain, shall we say, traditional titles for it. And one of the traditional titles that sailors, you know, pride themselves on, and in fact, I have the award when I was in the Navy, was I have what's called the shellback award. Now, a shellback is just one of the creatures of the sea. It's the crustacean. It's like a lobster. It's like a shrimp. You know, it's really the unclean animals of the sea. And the way the tradition is, if you're a shellback and you're in the Navy, it means that you've been on a U.S. capital ship and you have crossed the equator. You have gone to the southern hemisphere. Now, if you're from the southern hemisphere, that you go into the northern hemisphere, you also get the award. In other words, you have at sea gone to major different parts of the earth by traveling by sea. And in the ancient tradition, the idea is that you have crossed the equator without getting King Neptune's permission. And so you have to go through this King Neptune initiation procedure. You have to go through a shellback initiation for it. Now, I was on an aircraft carrier when we did this, and there came a time in May of 1975 where I was traveling on the ship from essentially Singapore down into Australia, and that caused me to cross the equator to go down the southern hemisphere of Australia, and we had this shellback initiation. And like I said, this is quite a naval tradition. I mean, I have a big certificate, an official entry in my military record, that I had been initiated, quote, into the solemn mysteries of the deep, that I was part of this great naval tradition that all navies in the world recognize. And it's all based on the idea of King Neptune and Poseidon, them being the god of the sea. And that's how far that Roman Greco tradition of idolatry has made its way even to this day. Well, you know, I didn't know it was a Roman Greco god. I just thought it was kind of a fun, goofy thing that we got to do in the Navy, and everybody was excited about getting the certificate and being a part of it. And just briefly, I'll just mention to you, it was quite a celebration that day. In fact, we discovered that if you aren't a shellback, that you are referred to as a polywog. Now, a polywog is that little goofy thing that swims around a little bit in a pond before it becomes a frog. And you're a polywog, and you're called a landlubber. But now when you cross the equator, well, you go through a trial. You have to come before King Neptune. You have to be found guilty for crossing the equator without his permission because he's in charge of the oceans. And you're found guilty, and then you get judged. You have to go through certain punishments. Now, I won't go into all the details, but essentially you go through this whole goofball process. And when you come out of the procedure, you can then proclaim you're a shellback, okay? And it was, quite honestly, it was a lot of fun the day that I went through it. By the way, the Navy has now ruled that out, and they're not permitted to do what I did. It's kind of an old naval tradition back for older fellows, but not so much today. And I got this big plaque. I've got this big plaque, and it shows King Neptune. He's on a chariot, and he's got dolphins swimming around with him, and he's the ruler of the raging main, and it's got a big ceremonial statement that says that I'm now an honored shellback, and all you lowly landlubbers must render honor to me as a shellback, and otherwise you'll suffer King Neptune's wrath, you know. It's Roman Greco idolatry. It's been made to be fun, but it's idolatry. Now, at the time I was going through it, I had no idea what this stuff was. Nobody had ever taught me about different idols and so forth in the world. I had the closest thing I ever got to any spiritual instruction on this was I had a Latin teacher who did a six-week segment on Greek mythology. And in the course of Greek mythology, she had explained all these different gods. Because by the way, let me just tell you that in the ancient times, mythology used to be theology. We now call it mythology. But you know what? It's just as persuasive and just as active today as it was back then. And it was idolatry back then, and it's idolatry still today, according to God. And let me tell you how this thing has migrated. This is going to be a little bit shocking to you. This King Neptune guy, this god, there were certain nations that were heavy nautical nations. They built ships and they traveled around the world and they explored the world. One of those nations was the Dutch. So the Dutch, you know, were a big part of moving out of Europe and coming over to the New World, along with the English and along with the Portuguese and the Spanish and so forth. They were one of the nations that came across. And their tradition, their custom about King Neptune was that when he was visiting ports, not only being the god of the sea, that he, in the winter time, he would come and he would give candies and care children, that he was very kind to children. And they had a name for him when he was doing this, and his name was Kinderklaas. Kinder for children. You ever heard of kindergarten? Yeah, well, Kinder is the Dutch phrase for children. He was called Kinder Claus, that King Neptune was very nice to small children and gave. And apparently this was in the winter months. When the Dutch and the others came over to the New World, something developed in this country that had to do with this Dutch tradition about Kinder Claus and about being in the winter time. And they came up with a holiday associated with King Neptune and Kinder Claus, and they began to celebrate a birth of the Messiah, but they mixed in this Kinder Claus thing. And in America, it came known as Santa Claus. Santa Claus is Kinder Claus, the Dutch Kinder Claus, which is King Neptune. And if you look at a picture of Santa Claus and you look at depictions of King Neptune, in fact, on my big shellback plaque, it's got a big thing of here's King Neptune riding in the chariot, you know, with all the sea creatures and so forth. It's Santa Claus. The big beard, you know, the whole Santa Claus look, you know, kind of a little bit like me, you know. By the way, at my 75th birthday, I announced to everybody that as a young boy, I never thought I would grow up and look as good as the Coca-Cola Santa Claus, but here I am killing it, okay? And by the way, I will tell you that, and I have to be careful going in the malls in December with the look that I have. Because that's how persuasive and pervasive King Neptune, this Roman Greco god, made it into all of the navies of the world and came to America so that you can now mix Santa Claus with this other thing about Christmas, the birth of the Messiah. Santa Claus, like Kinder Claus, like King Neptune, is idolatry. Now, I can tell you right now, there's going to be kind of an emotional reaction on the part of especially us Americans. Oh my gosh, you know, Monty, what are you doing? What are you saying? I mean, it's just a children's thing. Well, that's what they said with the Dutch. It's just a children thing. But that's where it came from. And that's what it is. Now, I got to ask you this question. What does God think about Santa Claus? He said, you're not going to have any false gods before me. And you're not going to make any idols. You're not going to put praise, thanksgiving, and adoration on anything above me. And oh, by the way, I will not tolerate sharing my glory or mixing anything about who I am with anything else. Oh my gosh, all of a sudden this second and third commandment of the Ten Commandments has suddenly become extremely relevant to our day. Do you understand the implications of that? Well, here's the problem. We have basically just flat dismissed this whole discussion. We, you know, a lot of people know this. In the last 20, 25 years, lots of people know that Christmas thing was never set up by God. It was never to be done. It's an American creation in the Western nations. And so forth. But let me go a step further. That's Santa Claus. Let's go more into the Christmas thing and how it all got tied together. I want to read a passage of Scripture to you from Jeremiah chapter 10. Maybe some of you are familiar with it, in which that God's going to talk about idolatry. And here's what he has to say. Jeremiah 10, verse 1. Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, house of Israel. This is what the Lord says. Do not learn the way of the nations And do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them. For the customs of the people are futile. For it is wood cut from the forest, the work of the hands of a craftsman with a cutting tool. They decorate the idol with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not totter. They are like a scarecrow in a cucumber field, and they cannot speak, and they must be carried, and because they cannot walk, do not fear them, for they do no harm, nor can they do any good. You know, each year, about the time Santa Claus shows up, most Christians go out and they get a Christmas tree. They get this evergreen tree, and it means that somebody went out, a craftsman went out and cut this thing down, and they carry it back. And when it gets bought by a person to bring to their home, they hook things to the bottom of it so it won't teeter or totter, and they put it in their house. And they decorate it with gold and silver and all kinds of attractive little ornaments and so forth in it. And by the way, there's not a spit of difference between an American decorating a Christmas tree and some of those guys in with worshiping Buddha that put their little gifts there by Buddha. Not a bit of difference. It's idolatry. Now, the average believer says, well, I'm celebrating the birth of the Messiah. That wasn't the time of the birth of Messiah, and any simple Bible study will tell you that. Well, it's my heart. My heart was intent. God says, I don't care what your heart intent, I don't want you practicing or having anything to do with idols. Now, for those of you who say, well, Monty, look, I'm not worshiping as an idol. You know, it's purely just decoration for the home. It's part of the holiday custom. It's a family event and so forth. And I say, look, I know deep down inside you're not viewing that as an idol. I know so. I'm in agreement with you. Except for that part where you get down on your knees and bow down before that thing to get the gifts out from under it. Now, that's the part where you definitely look like an idolater. You look like the ancient peoples that were guilty of idolatry, that you accuse them of idolatry. Now, those ancient peoples, if they were seeing you doing that at the Christmas tree, singing to it, praising it, decorating it, putting some real style into it. And every year you see all over the media, and you see all the different people, oh, you got to see our Christmas tree, how we decorated it. And you know, the ancient peoples would say, you're just as idolatrous as we are. But more importantly, rather than what others might say about it, what I might say about it, whatever. What do you think God thinks about it? Does God see that as idolatry? And do you believe that as a believer in the Creator, in the Redeemer, in the leading of the Holy Spirit, do you believe He really wants you doing that? I can't, I'm not going to speak for Him. I'm going to let the Spirit of the Lord speak to you about that. I'm going to let you and the Lord answer that question. But what I can say to you about it is that once you learn what the commandment of idolatry really is and having false gods and what the commandment is, most of the people that I know that have decided to follow the commandments of the Lord, they have gotten rid of that thing. They don't play Santa Claus anymore. They don't have Christmas trees anymore. They're looking around their houses at other traditions and other kinds of things that come from mythology, horoscopes, Babylonian religion. They look at all those things and they say, wait a minute, that's not for us anymore. We're going to obey the commandments of the Lord. We're still learning. We don't quite understand all of it, but we can see that now, and we're not going to do that anymore. Now, the intent of this program is not for you to get rid of your Christmas tree. If that's one of the applications you take from us, okay. My intent is not to devalue Santa Claus for you. My intent is not to destroy your family time for you. My intent is to warn you that the God we serve is a jealous God. And if you're practicing idolatry, what makes you think he's going to pay attention to your prayers? What makes you think that you can walk righteous and upright before him? Your faith at that point is false and futile. You are ignoring some of the most basic commandments God has said about how you will treat him. And if we think that we can just treat him with disdain, that we can devalue him by valuing other things above him, and so forth, he has warned us, look, I'm a jealous God, and I will punish on this issue. In fact, my punishment will not only stop with you, it'll extend to your children and to your grandchildren. And he specifically expressly says that the measure of from generation to generation about whether or not you love his commandments and follow him and so forth is, what are you teaching your children? And I can tell you this, the whole focus of Santa Claus and Christmas, and I need somebody to really tell me, no, this is not true. The real benefit is the so-called joy you have with your children with it. So it turns out all that Christmas stuff and all that Santa Claus stuff, it's intended from parents for their children. I was taught it when I was a child. It was embedded into me way stronger than God. I was much more interested in Christmas and Santa Claus than anything else in my life as a child. I was taught well. And to this day, that's still what that teaching is. Do you understand the conflict, spiritual conflict, that you brought to your own house? Maybe that's the reason why God emphasizes when he gives this commandment about no idolatry, that I will punish not only you, but to your children and your children's children. I understand the impact of this idolatrous activity, that it carries through generations. He said the punishment will extend to the generations. Well, the one thing that I can tell you right now as a believer of God, the one thing I don't want to do is I don't want to bring any curses on my children. I certainly want to set a proper example for my children. And I want my children to be successful, and I want my grandchildren to be successful. That's the reason why I made the decision when I became messianic, no more Santa Claus and no more Christmas trees. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't love my family, my extended family, and where they're at. I can still have family time with them. That doesn't mean that I can't share a gift with a family member or a friend. But it does mean that I'm not going to teach my children this nonsense of Roman Greco gods and traditions. And I'm not going to carry forth these ancient gods into this generation and give it to my children and my grandchildren. That's where we're at. So as we come to a conclusion on this episode of the program, I want to set the stage for the final episode, because we're going to talk about something even more powerful than silly things like Santa Claus and Christmas trees when it comes to the subject of idolatry. We're going to talk about the worst form of idolatry, when you create a god within your own imagination. I look forward to the next program on that. Shalom to all of you.